the edge of our hope, at the end of our time. We have chosen not only to believe in ourselves, but in each other. Today we face the monsters that are at our door. Today we are canceling the apocalypse.
Now get the hell out of our galaxy.
The strength of this starship lay in its diversity.
You see, our glorious diversity, that is not a threat to who we are. It makes us who we are.
You don't just let things happen. You make a stand. You say no. You have the guts to do what's right when everyone else just runs away.
But we must fight this darkness that is threatening to engulf us. Each of us must be a ray of hope.
Rebellions are built on hope.
Welcome to the Skiffing and Fantasy Show. I'm Paul Weimer, and today on Signal Boost, we have Mike Martinez.
Hello.
Hi, Mike. Mike Martinez is here to talk about his forthcoming book in the MJ12 series. Isn't that right, Mike?
That is right, and I love talking about books. They're awesome. I mean, I'd like to think that my books are awesome, but books in general are awesome.
I agree. This is why we're having this conversation, so why don't you tell me about MJ12 Shadows?
All right, so this is the second book in the Majestic 12 series, which is a series of books that are sort of a superpowered Cold War spy series. Not necessarily superpowered in the sense of spandex and capes, but in that ordinary average Americans really just suddenly and mysteriously developing these abilities, and the government, in its infinite wisdom, deciding to hide them, use them in covert actions against the Soviets in the Cold War, who suddenly have similar ones. So that's the basis of this series. This being the second book, MJ12 Shadows. This one, a little less mythology. Obviously, when you have the first book of the series, you got to get a lot of stuff off the ground. This one is able, I think, to just to go from the gate and just say, we are going to do a cool spy story. And this is set largely in Syria in 1949, which in our real history was honestly an absolute shit show. The CIA sponsored a coup, and then there were two other coups after that in the same year. It was an amazing display of American overreach. We literally overthrew a democratically elected government to put in a strong man who would allow us to put in an oil pipeline. So just right there, you have a really compelling narrative. And to be able to take that real history, explore it through a fictional setting and through characters who are struggling with their own superpowers and their own abilities and what makes them human versus better than or worse than human, is just a lot of fun.
I had to start reading after I'd read this novel to find out how much have you actually taken from real history, and you took a lot. So how did in the world did you find out about the tangled, sad, chaotic mess that was Syria in 1949?
So one of the things that attracted me to doing the early Cold War as a setting for sort of superpowered spies was that the CIA had a massive history and a relatively unknown history of regime change, really from 1949 through the 1950s into the 1960s. So many dirty tricks. So that was just kind of the first one really on the list. And I just, you know, when you're researching CIA activity during that Cold War era, Syria, Iran, Guatemala, so many just countries that we just decided to go and mess with. So, yeah.
Interesting. So this is the second book in the series. So, and you do introduce some new talents on our side. So what was it like creating new talents, having already done that in the first book? What did you learn? How was it different creating new ones to add into the team?
So when I think about superpowers, I want them to be unique. I don't want them to necessarily be equal in power or strength. You know, we're not leveling up an adventuring party here. There are some powers that are very subtle and very unique and very interesting, and there are some that are pretty simple and mundane. And you know, I have a character who can leap very far and fast, and that can still be useful compared to a character who can shoot fire or lightning. But the other thing, when I think about those abilities, is I want to be sure that there's some edge to them, that it's not always easy. Maybe that is an actual side effect that sort of hovers around that particular ability, or it may simply be just there is a psychological impact to having that ability. We all look at Superman, for example, and he can, you know, he pretty much do whatever the heck he wants. And the only thing that's stopping him is kryptonite and a moral code. And I like to think that, you know, there's a more nuanced approach. And that's really what I tried to do here. And it's just a lot of fun to see, you know, to take maybe abilities that we think we know from comic books or whatever and give them a little twist.
I think you succeeded quite nicely with that. And you did do a lot of the heavy lifting of the mythology in this first book, but I understand in the second book you do make some more revelations about what really is going on.
Right. You know, if you are going to create superpowers out of the blue, nothing really happens out of the blue. These abilities came up via these sort of physical spatial anomalies, vortexes, in the wake of the Hiroshima bombing. One showed up in Hiroshima, and another showed up in Berlin, thanks to the machinations of course, Nazis. You can't do World War II stuff and Cold War stuff without having some rogue Nazis. Sadly, we have American Nazis today, but that's another sad, sad, horrible story. Anyway, so you have these anomalies, and the government, of course, studies them. And the government, of course, doesn't fully understand them, but the government uses the people who have these abilities anyway, because that's what the American government does. There were some people, for example, when we dropped the atomic bombs, didn't really know if we'd ignite the entire atmosphere or not. Some people thought there was a slight chance we might fry ourselves. We dropped the bomb anyway. Granted, you know, most physicists were like, dude, that's overreach. But we have a history of ignoring consequence. Humanity has a history of ignoring consequence. It's not an American thing. It's a human thing. So they don't really know what these vortexes are, but in the second book, you get some more of that, I guess, mythology and backstory. You know, I wanted to do a little less sort of meta story with this particular series, but at the end of the day, you know, you still want that thread through for people who are following along.
I mean, that's one of the things I did like about your Daedalus series was that meta thread and the slow revelation of things. So I was, it's a little lighter on the ground. These are a little more standalone, pick up and read on an airplane and dive into, but I do like to have that continual thread, and you do, it might be lighter, but you do provide it. I was like, oh God, really? Really? Really?
Well, thanks. I mean, that's awesome. And I love hearing that. I mean, when you think about a spy thriller, it's like you can pick up James Bond story. You know about Bond, you know about Moneypenny, you know about all that stuff. He's got his own mythology, and maybe he follows it along to a certain degree, but it's still a self-contained story, and that's kind of what I wanted to do with this particular series.
Well, one other thing you do in this series, which I think you do very well in these first two books, is you address the social problems of America in the 1940s and 50s, and I wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit about what you were trying to accomplish with that.
I don't know if I was particularly trying to accomplish anything other than recognize that these issues existed. When you think about the spy thrillers, especially if you think about, you know, John Le Carre, or Le Carre, I always pronounce that wrong, or, you know, Ian Fleming or any of them, or even Tom Clancy, they tend not to delve too deeply into the issues of the day in terms of race and sex and color and all of that stuff and gender and that sort of thing. But the 1940s were such a different time. And, you know, you have if you know, a sort of proto supernatural vortex imbues people with powers, they aren't going to just imbue white people and they're not just going to imbue men. So we have women, we have African Americans, we have a Japanese American, we have, you know, America represented. And in doing so in 1949, you were going to have people whose opinions of black people would be abhorrent today. And you have to be recognize that, and you have to do the work. I am not African American, but I hope I did the character justice in saying, you know, this is, I researched extensively and I talked to people who had relatives go through segregation and racism in the 1940s and could tell me about those experiences, so that when, you know, I present a character, that I can do that character justice and not just, you know, call that character names or treat that character horribly, but have that character, have the understanding around that character to know how that person would react and the resentment that that character would feel and what they felt that they could do in response to that. And of course, when you have a superpower, your response to that might be very different, which is something that, you know, I'm sort of slowly exploring in this series as well. When you talk about a woman, African-American man, who are going against the norms of the day. And I'm just like, oh, I'm not going to put up with your crap because, you know, I can screw with your mind, or I can sap the life out of you. And maybe you don't want to tell me to sit in the back of the bus.
Interesting. One other thing I see you done with this series is that you're retelling history and sliding around it rather than just going straight out for an alternate history. Events happen as they happen, but we get a new perspective. So I was just curious as to why do it that way. Why do a secret history, as it were, rather than a straight out alternate history?
You know, I have a deep and abiding respect for alternate history novelists. They do amazing work. Harry Turtledove, he's the OG, right? Mm-hmm. I mean,
yes, he is.
And he blurb met the first one of this series, which I swear to God just brought a tear to my eye. I'm like, oh my God, validation. It was great. So, you know, alternate history is hard. You're taking some serious turns. You are doing an immense amount of legwork. And maybe some point someday I will do that. I think I got there in the first series of books I did, the Daedalus series, and, you know, the third book, The Venusian Gambit, you know, you had Napoleon invade England successfully. So it's work. But this struck me, this particular series is about spies. It's about what happens behind the scenes. It's what happens in the shadows. And I thought about taking a turn, but really, as we discussed, the history in and of itself was still pretty crazy, that I didn't feel like I needed to create huge things outside of history to play with, because there was just such this rich material within history that I could simply use. And maybe there is a certain, like, you know, yes, our, you know, we're very proud of America. I am fortunate to live in America and have a voice and be able to write. But America did some really crazy, ugly stuff. And maybe when you, like you, after reading the book, went, how much of that was real? Oh my God, so much of it.
It was an eye-opener. I mean, I've known about some of the various things the CIA did, like, say, Iran and Central America and the Caribbean. I had no idea about Syria. None.
And Paul, that scene where they invade Miles's house?
Yeah.
Aside from actually having my characters there, yeah, happened.
Holy crap.
Stupid. It happened. So now you gotta, everybody listening, you gotta go read it.
Yeah.
Because basically two CIA guys with a briefcase full of money and no common sense overthrew a government. And frankly, they shouldn't have even lived because they were so stupid. So that right there tells you just how much fun it was to do that history. And why mess with that?
I am enlightened. I see your point, and your point is well taken. I mean, there are some interesting things in this book, like the revelation about Redacted, but we'll have to let readers, when they get it, their mitts on this book, find out for themselves just what I was talking about.
And yes, I think in the third book, you will see maybe that's just the way I do alternate history, in that, you know, by the time I'm in the third book of a series, you'll see a slight turn. I think that I'm writing that third book now, and there will be a slight turn. I'm not going to break history per se, but it's going to get bent a little bit.
I definitely am looking forward to it, and I hope listeners will, if they haven't picked up the first book, they should, and if they have, I'm hoping they will pick up the second book in short order.
It's out September 5th in paperback, and I'd love you all if you went and got it, because, you know, I get to write more books that way.
That sounds good. And where can people find you on the internet?
I am at michaeljmartinez.net, and I'm on Twitter at mikemartinez72, and I am not on Facebook. Sorry.
That's a valid lifestyle choice. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
All right. Thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for listening to another episode of Signal Boost. Go check out Mike Martinez's Majestic 12 series today. Thanks. And see you.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanti Show. I'm Jen, and today on Signal Boost, we have our arch nemesis, Patrick Hester, Hugo Award-winning podcaster, writer of many things, I'll let him tell you about those, functional nerd, and author, specifically, of the urban fantasy novel Into the Fire, which came out early this year. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Thanks, Jen. I'm happy to be on this inaugural episode.
Clearly, it's the inaugural episode because it's the first one you've been on, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, so it's the only one that exists in your mind?
Yes, ask Paul. He knows all about it.
Of course. Arg.
Bwahaha.
Shaking my fist at you.
That's okay. You can just kick my butt in a game in like a week or two.
Exactly. And I will take great pleasure in doing that. So why don't you tell us about Samantha Cain and Into the Fire?
It's a book. I wrote it. Someone published
it.
Talk about a journey. It's been years and years in the making, and I've written several different versions of it. It was inspired when I first came to Denver and just thought this was a great kind of fodder ground for storytelling. And so I started writing this story about a female cop who finds out that everything she thought she knew was wrong and magic is real, and suddenly people want to kill her because she knows that, and adventure ensues.
I always like adventure.
Yeah, adventure's good.
But with this one, I keep wanting to say, you're a wizard, Samantha, or something along those lines.
That's basically what happens, you know. I want to go back a second, though, and say that, you know, the journey getting this book published was an interesting one. And the best part so far has been the fact that you did mention that I won a Hugo Award, and I appreciate that, but I got to remind you it's two. And
I just said Hugo Award winning. I wasn't specific about it.
You've seen them. They're on the show. You've tried to take one home with
you. I might just do that still.
Oh, my goodness. But actually, it's kind of funny that you even brought that up, because today, of all days, Facebook likes to remind you of things. So Facebook spit up the picture from the Hugo Awards where it's all the winners, and it's proof that I was actually in the same room breathing the same air with George R.R. Martin. But the other cool thing is that one of my fellow winners was Galen Dara. And Galen and I have known each other for many years. We met at the Worldcon in Reno, and we hung out together along with the Ink Punks. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Ink Punks, but we hung out and had a great time that weekend. And just kind of that friendship blossomed. And when this book was published, it was actually published through a smaller press called Wordfire. And they, you know, they're a full press. They'll do everything for you. But they also have a little clause that says, if you want, you can go out and you can commission an artist to do a cover for you. And they're fine with that, which most publishers aren't. And I saw that and I just thought, oh my gosh, I got to do this. So I emailed Galen and I said, you know, I would really love it if you have the time, because I don't think she'd won the professional Hugo Award yet. She'd just won the fan award. And so I said, you know, if I can afford you and if you're willing, I'd love to. And she just jumped on it. And so you've seen the cover. It's just absolutely gorgeous. It stands out. It's Sam standing there and she's got the fire coming out of her hands. And, you know, there's a dark and mysterious person in the background and all that good stuff. And it's just a gorgeous cover. So number one, Galen Dara. Gorgeous cover. Judge the book by the cover and just go buy it.
That's actually, it's a really good selling point, I gotta
say.
It is. Galen Dara does absolutely gorgeous work. I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with her. I'm curious, though, because this is an urban fantasy, and it is, by most accounts, it does follow a lot of the, you know, fairly typical urban fantasy tropes of suddenly finding out that there's more than you expected there was in the world.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. So I'm kind of curious, what attracted you very specifically to urban fantasy? And why was Sam's story specifically an urban fantasy story? But also, what is your unique take and Samantha's unique experience within an urban fantasy world?
So, okay, there are some of those tropes, but I tried to take things back to, like, there are vampires, but they are horribly evil. You do not want to have sex with them. They want to kill you, number one. Which for a lot of stories here for a while, you know, vampires became sexy.
They did.
And so I wanted to go back to they just see you as food. They just want to kill you or rule you. My vampires are Russian. So number one, like they have taken attractive bodies occasionally, but they're very Russian in that, you know, the head of the family is Russian and he just does not care. He just wants to kill people, kill them and rule them. Those are his goals. I have some other kind of tropes in there. Like you said, she's a cop. She's second generation. So she is trying to follow in the footsteps of her father, who in her world is Superman, right? Her dad can do no wrong, even though they clash all the time, right? It's one of those things where you're so much alike that you can't get along. And she just wants to like live up to his very oppressive shadow kind of thing. You know, it's like he has cast a long shadow across Denver and everybody loves him and he was a beat cop and everybody knew him. And she just wants to live up to that, but at the same time, do him proud and kind of surpass him, which she does. In the opening scenes of the book, we find out that she has become a detective, which is something that he never was able to do. And so she has become a detective and, but then she screws it all up. So there are those kinds of tropes, right? There's wizards, but in my book, wizard is gender neutral. It's not male or female. If you are this person who can control magic, you're a wizard. So Sam is a wizard. And I have werewolves. I have other kinds of things in there. I also deal with kind of science fictional tropes. It's actually part of a multiverse. And they talk about that in the book. You know, they basically said that there was no magic on our world until someone on another world screwed up and the two worlds kind of collided. And then they tried to fix it. And when they fixed it, some magical people got left on this side and some non-magical people got left on the other side and everything's all screwed up now. So that's why we have elves and vampires and werewolves in our world. And that's why they have just normal human beings on their world. So there is that. The other thing that I did that I tried to make it different, because I haven't seen this a lot in urban fantasy, is I gave her a huge, big family. I made her Irish Catholic, right? So she's Irish Catholic. She's from Chicago. I'm from Chicago. I'm Irish Catholic, though I've gotten over it. She's Irish Catholic. She has a big family. She has mom guilt. You know, her mom is ever present in her life as a pressure point, always constantly making her feel guilty about everything she's ever done. Same with her dad. You know, he's ill and her mom never lets her forget that he's ill and that the family needs her help. She has an older brother. She has younger brothers. She has a nephew. She has cousins. She has the whole Irish Catholic experience, including all the wonderful guilt that comes with just being an Irish Catholic. So I tried to throw all that in there. And because normally you see these urban fantasies where people are orphans or they are, you know, the last surviving member of their family, or they don't know who the heck they are. Right. They were just left on a doorstep. You know, those kinds of tropes. I wanted to do something different. So I gave her this huge, big family. Now, to answer the question about why an urban fantasy, I don't actually know. I never read urban fantasies when I started writing this. I read them after. So I was living out by Arapahoe High School in a condo. And no one listening to the show knows what I'm talking about, but Jen does. And I had just moved into that place. And a friend of mine who was a guildie in World of Warcraft would come over and we'd sit there and we'd write. And, you know, it's one of those things where there's two people in the room and they are 3 to 4 feet apart from each other. And for 4 to 6 hours, they don't say a single word. They're just chatting back and forth in a chat window as they're writing.
That's actually my house. So, yeah, I get you.
And for some reason, it just popped into my head, this character of Samantha Cain. And I was a little nervous about it at first because I never really tried to write female characters before. And at the time, like I said, I was playing World of Warcraft, and that same guildie challenged me and said, you know, if you're uncomfortable writing female characters because you don't think you can do it, why don't you role play a female character and see if you can do that? And I did, and it went really, really well, and people very much enjoyed that character. She was very different. And that kind of released me and showed me that I could write a female character. And so I started writing this story and I would share it with my female friends and say, you know, am I getting this right? Am I doing this wrong? What am I doing? And they enjoyed it for the most part. And they told me where I was screwing things up you know, here and there. And then I would fix it and I would go back and I would redraft. And to the point now, when I give it to readers, they say, wow, this is a really well-developed character. This is a really well-developed world. So they enjoy it. And all that work that went into it was worth it.
Awesome. I'm glad you did that as a woman.
I am too.
I mean, it's always nice when men actually take the time to understand their female characters.
Yeah. And it's funny because I remember at the time, after I'd written the first draft, I decided I needed a critique group. I needed to get with some other authors and get feedback on this book. And I found one in Colorado Springs called the Colorado Springs Fiction Writers Group. And I took the book down there, and I remember there was probably, I want to say, like a 30-minute argument between the female writers in the room over my choice of the word blouse. I had said that she grabbed a blouse. And someone said, no, she's too young to grab a blouse. She would grab a shirt because it's first person. That's the other thing. It's a first person. And I just kind of sat there while they argued it out until they finally decided, no, she's too young. She would not say the word blouse. You have to change this to shirt. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, that's actually a fairly accurate representation of a young woman. I definitely do not own any blouses.
Understood. And she's supposed to be like a 30-ish. And so that's another like valuable insight for me, you know, sitting there and getting that feedback from other writers. And I also, before that draft, I played it very straight. It was almost like a straightforward mystery. And then to your point, I read my first urban fantasy, Stormfront.
Great book.
Great book. Tons of humor in it. And I went, oh, huh. And then I read something called The Parasol Protectorate, Gail Carriger. Again, tons of humor. And actually in her book, like tons of innuendo, because just the characters, which if you haven't read that book, Jen, you need to read it. You read the first trilogy. It's hilarious. So anyway, I read that and then I said, oh, it's okay to put humor in these books in urban fantasy. So then I went back and I put in my sense of humor. And then I said, I need to dial back my sense of humor, which Jen, I think, can appreciate.
You have a sense of humor, Patrick? I wasn't aware.
I do. Yes, I do. So I had to, so I did it a little more. And then that's the draft that I actually took to the critique group. And the very first chapter that I submitted, someone in the critique group told me that they were reading it in a restaurant while eating lunch and drinking coffee. And they apologized because the physical copy that they brought back to me was covered in coffee. Because they were laughing. Something made it so funny. They spit coffee all over because they just couldn't keep it in. They just spit it all over it. And so there was a note on there saying, I apologize. This was just so funny.
So listeners, if you get this book, it comes with a warning. It should not be read while drinking.
I did put that humor in there. And I also sold the book on the premise of, you know, if Harry Dresden had a sister, that would be Sam, because she has that same kind of sensibility. There's a great scene where she has to go pick up her little brother who, because their dad is sick, he has decided just to rebel. And so none of the rules apply to him. He's just going to do whatever he wants. He goes to a goth club on Colfax he doesn't know it, but it's actually run by the vampire. And she goes and she pulls him out and she actually perp walks him. She basically runs him down, tackles him, takes his arms behind his back while he's screaming for help, and she handcuffs him and perp walks him back to the car, showing off her badge and telling everybody just to back off, that this has nothing to do with them. Throws him in the back seat of the car, where he immediately starts to kick the back of the car, the seat, right? Which is what a brother does or a kid does, right? He's just kicking the back of the seat, and she's getting angrier and angrier as she's driving down I-25, and she's telling him, you know, you can't keep doing this. And then he just says something bad about their dad, and it's a screech, halt, pull over to the side of the road, dive into the back seat, and immediately start giving him a Charlie horse. His hands behind his back, he can't do anything about it, and she's just, you know, hammering him on the leg to give him a Charlie horse. It's just this brother-sister sibling moment that I think we can all relate to, but that is also absolutely hilarious.
That was actually one of my questions, was how did family become such a central part of this story, her relationship with her family? And what do you think that connection really brings to the urban fantasy genre?
Well, again, it's the reason that I did it was because I haven't seen it before. So I wanted that different thing in there. It's also there's not really romance. There's kind of a flirtatious moment. There's her ex-boyfriend is in it, and that makes her uncomfortable when she has to run into him. She kind of starts to feel a little bit of something for her mentor, the guy who's teaching her magic. But again, that doesn't go anywhere really. So, you know, I didn't go down those roads. And I just think the family dynamic makes it a more human story. It makes it grounds her, and it especially grounds her when she needs to be grounded, because the magic ends up being something that if she'd been with it all her life, it would be fine. But as the floodgates are opened, it really starts to mess with her, and it messes with her not only mentally, but physically. It starts to attack her body because she just does not know how to control it. And if she doesn't learn how to control it, it doesn't matter if the people hunting her find her, the magic will kill her. And that's kind of the whole into the fire bit. Fire is the easiest magic. It's the most seductive magic. It's the most powerful because it's just fire, and it's living and it's breathing, and it will seduce her and it will cause problems if she can't get it under control.
Sounds great, Patrick. Why don't you let us know where we can find you and where people can buy Into the Fire?
So first off, I'm ATFMB, all things from my brain. I've just had that forever. I'm ATFMB on Twitter. I'm ATFMB on Facebook. I have a website called ATFMB.com, all things from my brain. So those are the places you can find me. I also co-host the Functional Nerds podcast. And you can find that on functionalnerds.com. I co-host that with John Anilio, and we've been doing that for, what is it, like 29 years now, 50 years sometimes?
That's I'm going to have to cut this whole part anyway, so it doesn't matter.
So and then I used to do the SF Signal podcast over at sfsignal.com. And those episodes are still out there as well. So you can find all that online. The book itself, this is what's really cool. So Wordfire is a small enough press that they had trouble getting into brick and mortar stores. So for the most part, it's been available online. So you can find it on Amazon, barnesandnoble.com, kobo.com. You can get physical copies there. You can get ebooks. However, they just did a deal with Ingram, which is the big distributor. And now the book is available at every bookstore. You just have to ask for it. They can now order it. So if you are a book buyer at a bookstore, you can order my book. And it's all the normal stuff that you're used to from any other publisher. But please ask for my book. And if you're, I believe it's Toronto. If you're in Toronto, a listener of Functional Nerds is a librarian there and actually got the book for the library, which I thought was pretty awesome. But anywhere that fine books are sold, you can apparently now buy my book.
Thank you so much for joining us on Signal Boost to talk about Into the Fire.
You're welcome. And I look forward to seeing, you know, how this new show goes for you.
It's fun, if nothing else. So thank you, everybody, for joining us on Signal Boost. And make sure you go check out Patrick's work at all the places that he just mentioned. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show, and on Patreon at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. Our intro and outro music comes from The Launch by Cronux. You can find out more about their music at freemusicarchive.org.